KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Even in the very last days of this government, we will not let Canadians down today and long into the future.
Canada's Liberal Party picks its new leader and the country's next prime minister. For Sunday, March 9th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Ahead, we'll head to Selma, Alabama, where ceremonies mark the 60th anniversary of a key turning point in the civil rights movement. We'll also go to Thailand to hear about a crackdown on hubs of online scams.
We've seen up to 7,000 people, we think, now released from these scam centers. The problem is that they're now stuck in a limbo position.
And we'll remember acclaimed furniture designer Tom Moser.
What makes beauty in my world is that which serves. And if it doesn't have a functional component, a strong sense of utility, I am not interested in it.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Mark Carney, the former governor of the Bank of Canada, has become the new leader of the Liberal Party and is now prime minister designate. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, Carney hinted strongly that a general election is on the way.
Carney has flirted with politics several times but never actually taken the plunge until Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced early last month that he would be resigning. During the Liberal Party gathering in Toronto, Carney said he would stand shoulder to shoulder with his fellow candidates in fighting the next election, with the focus on the challenge from the White House. Carney won handily with 85% of the members voting for him. Former Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland came in second with 8%. Carney has not been tested politically. He has repeatedly pledged to call an election soon so he can win a seat in Parliament and fight the Conservatives who are leading in the polls. Parliament resumes on March 24th. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
House Republicans are trying another stopgap extension to avoid a partial government shutdown this week. They released a bill yesterday that would pay for the government through September 30th. NPR's Tamara Keith has more.
It basically punts the big decisions, the deep cuts that conservatives want, until later this year. It keeps the top line budget number the same as the last fiscal year, but shifts around some funding. It increases defense spending and decreases non-defense spending. It boosts funding for immigration enforcement, but doesn't include additional disaster assistance for the California wildfires or the hurricanes last year. In short, it's meant to keep congressional Republicans content and buy time for them to work on what President Trump really wants, which is big tax cuts and a significant boost in immigration spending.
NPR's Tamara Keith reporting. Israel says it will send a delegation to Qatar tomorrow to further ceasefire talks. Phase one of a fragile ceasefire deal ended last month, and talks for the next phase, which would see a permanent end to the war, were supposed to have started weeks ago. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi has more.
In a statement, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office said its delegation is going to Doha to try to, quote, advance ceasefire negotiations. Israel has been pressuring Hamas to accept an extension of the first phase of a ceasefire deal that would retain its right to go back to war and see half the hostages held in Gaza freed. Hamas says it wants to begin second phase talks that would see a permanent end to the war and a total withdrawal of Israeli troops from Gaza. The militant group said it had ended a round of ceasefire talks with Egypt this week. This all comes after the White House confirmed it had held direct talks with Hamas about the ceasefire deal. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Jerusalem.
U.S. futures contracts are trading lower at this hour. Dow futures down more than 0.5%. NASDAQ futures are down 1%. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. In Selma, Alabama this weekend, ceremonies were held today marking the 60th anniversary of a key event in the civil rights movement when voting rights marchers were attacked. The violence on the Edmund Pettus Bridge shocked the nation, galvanizing support for the Voting Rights Act of 1965. This annual commemoration pays homage to those who fought to secure voting rights for Black Americans. The Vatican says Pope Francis is showing signs of mild improvement as he continues to receive treatment at a Rome hospital. NPR's Joe Hernandez reports Francis hasn't appeared publicly for weeks.
Francis was admitted to the hospital nearly a month ago for a case of bronchitis. Since then, the 88-year-old has also suffered a polymicrobial infection as well as pneumonia in both lungs. According to the Holy See press office, doctors say he's responded well to his treatment, but his prognosis is guarded, which means the outcome of his illness is still uncertain. In the text of his Sunday Angelus prayer released by the Vatican, Francis thanked healthcare workers across the globe, including his own care team. He said, quote, "During my prolonged hospitalization here, I too experienced the thoughtfulness of service and the tenderness of care, in particular from the doctors and healthcare workers, whom I thank from the bottom of my heart." Joe Hernandez, NPR News.
At the weekend box office, Mickey 17 debuted in the top spot with an estimated $19 million in ticket sales. In second place, Captain America Brave New World with $8 million. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Canada's ruling Liberal Party has a new leader.
In first place, the next Prime Minister of Canada, Mark Carney.
Mark Carney won the Liberal Party's leadership contest today and will now replace Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who stepped down earlier this year after almost a decade in office. Carney is considered a political outsider, but his vast experience will be critical as he takes on Canada's economic challenges and President Trump's economic warfare. NPR's international affairs correspondent Jackie Northam has been following the story and joins us now. Hello.
Hi, Scott.
So tell us about Mark Carney.
Well, he's 59 years old. As you say, he's considered a political outsider and really wasn't known in Canada before he entered the leadership race. He does have an international reputation. He spent time on Wall Street and was governor of the Bank of England during Brexit. And he's also headed up the Bank of Canada. You know, all that expertise is going to come in very handy as he tackles Canada's economy, but also dealing with President Trump's seemingly chaotic trade policies. And he indicated that he and Canada were expecting a fight. Here he is.
We're all being called to stand up for each other and for the Canadian way of life. So let me ask you, who's ready? Pierre Flair. Who's ready to stand up for Canada with me?
And, you know, Scott Carney said really that the relationship between Canada and the U.S. is in uncharted waters.
Right. It's been clear that President Trump and Prime Minister Trudeau do not get along. That relationship has gotten increasingly contentious in the past month or so. Can we expect a different dynamic between Carney and the president?
It's hard to say. You're right that Trudeau and Trump don't get along and that the relationship has been unraveling pretty fast recently with, you know, Trump calling Trudeau governor and Trudeau calling the president Donald. So Carney represents a fresh start between the countries. You know, he comes across as steady and low-key, which could be helpful in negotiations with the U.S. But, you know, Carney also made it clear that he will be tough on Trump, and he has vowed that Canada will never be part of the United States.
How exactly have those comments from President Trump or these tariffs had an effect on this leadership race and, more broadly, politics in Canada right now?
Oh, sure. I mean, Trump's taunts to turn Canada into the 51st state and, you know, his demeaning comments about Trudeau have done a lot to unite Canadians and energize politics. People are angry and disappointed, and you've seen this wave of nationalism sweeping across the country. But I think it's fair to say that Trump has inadvertently hurt the opposition Conservative Party. You know, for more than a year, it was up 20 points in the polls. People were fed up with 10 years of Trudeau and the Liberals. But the conservative leader, Pierre Poilievre, is seen by many in Canada now as pro-Trump and pro-MAGA, something both he and Trump deny. But that reputation has cost the conservatives, and they're now running pretty much neck and neck with the liberals in the polls. So we'll see how that turns out in a federal election due later this year.
So Carney is now the leader of the Liberal Party. He's not yet prime minister. When do we expect him to be sworn in?
Well, there will be a short transition period for Trudeau to hand over power, and that could take, you know, people are expecting about a week. Under Canada's election law, a federal election must be held by October, but Carney could call one any time now. Or, well, you know, an election can be triggered by a vote of non-confidence in the government when Parliament resumes later this month. You know, but regardless, Scott, whoever becomes Prime Minister is going to have to deal with Trump, tariffs, and the threats to Canada's sovereignty.
That is NPR International Affairs correspondent Jackie Northam. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Scott.
Online scam centers have flourished in Southeast Asia. These are the places where people scam victims into sending them money, usually after they've built up an online relationship with the target. But the people working in these centers are often victims themselves of human trafficking and forced labor. That is the case of some 7,000 people on a border right now between Thailand and Myanmar. They are from all over the world, and they face an uncertain future as governments in the region crack down on these online scam centers. Here to explain is journalist Jan Kamazin-Brumby, who joins us from Thailand. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with that. There are thousands of people stuck in Myanmar. Who are these people and how did they end up there?
Well, these really are people from all across the globe. There are dozens of countries represented here, and they're people with language skills, sometimes people with master's educations and PhDs. And many of them, they applied for jobs, they sent in CVs, they had multiple interviews, they even negotiated and signed contracts with HRs, all for jobs in Thailand that they thought they were going to be going to, but that never actually existed. I spoke to Amy Miller. She works for Acts of Mercy International. It's an NGO that's based on the ground here, and they've been doing work for years trying to get some of these people out of these scam centers once they're in. This is what she explained to me.
Often it starts with them receiving either an ad on Facebook, on Telegram, on WeChat. They go on a website. They go through an interview process that often looks very legitimate. They are given a flight to Bangkok, paid for, and then all of a sudden they're driven 6 or 8 hours up to our borderline.
And once they're taken up to the border, it's really too late for them. Essentially, many of them don't even realize that they've crossed the border until their phone doesn't have any connection and until they're surrounded by militia and by soldiers in Myanmar. And by that time, it's really too late.
Who is behind all of this? What essentially sounds like human trafficking?
Myanmar has been in the throes of a civil war ever since the coup that took place in 2021. And in this civil war, we've seen different militia groups that are each holding different areas of control, especially along this Thai-Myanmar border. And it's within this chaos that we've seen largely Chinese organized crime groups that begin to use the disorder for their own benefit. They've been paying millions of dollars to rent land along the border. And in that land, they've been building scam compounds. And these scam compounds house, we think, between 120 and up to 200,000 scam workers that are working there at the moment. Now, so far, it's been a win-win, at least for those on the higher levels. The compound bosses get to run these scams, and they've been raking in billions of dollars in revenue, taking money from unsuspecting victims in the United States, in North Africa, in North America, in Europe, and really across the world.
And just to help us understand this, are these call centers behind this increased proliferation in random texts that people get? You know, hi, I lost your number. Who are you? Or is it a wide range of different schemes?
That really is, if you're getting messages like that, that really is one of the playbooks that these scam centers have been operating. Now, there are different scam centers. We think there are up to 70 of them just in the stretch across Mesot, the border town that I'm in now, and across the 70-kilometer stretch on the other side. And different compounds will have different playbooks and different strategies that they use. But essentially, there are different teams within these scam centers, and each team will be tasked with doing a different job. Some of them will be tasked with gathering contact information. Others will be tasked with researching people to find people that might have money and could potentially become good victims, victims that will be able to invest a lot of money. Then there are people that reach out and make the initial contact. Those are the kinds of messages that you might receive if there's someone who's told you that they've lost their phone, someone messaging you to say, hello, my name is Ricky, how are you? Then once the victims have been hooked on, once they've been speaking to someone for a while, it moves up the chain of command.
Let's get back, though, to the beginning of this conversation, though, because the people in these call centers, as you have described, seem like victims themselves. They're there under false pretenses. They don't seem to be allowed to leave. What's happened here?
So what we've seen in the last few weeks, really, has been a crackdown. And that all happened because a Chinese celebrity was trafficked into one of these camps. It caused an uproar on social media in China, and it pushed the government in Beijing to increase their pressure on the authorities in Thailand. And the Thai authorities in the last few weeks have cut off the electricity supply and cut off the flow of fuel across the border that these scam compounds and the areas around them have been relying on. That's put increasing pressure on the militias that control these grounds. And because of that, we've seen the militias beginning to crack down on the scam centers themselves. We've seen up to 7,000 people, we think now, released from these scam centers. The problem is that they're now stuck in a limbo position. They aren't able to enter into Thailand yet, and they also aren't being housed in the scam compounds either. And so we've been hearing quotes from people telling us that they're living in unsanitary positions, that they're sharing bathrooms between dozens of people, that they haven't been fed enough food, and they're stuck in a limbo until the coordination efforts between the governments can be sorted out and can repatriate them back home.
Any sense of what the timeline is for that? I mean, this seems like an untenable situation right now.
Well, I've spoken to people that have been there for weeks already living in these camps. Some people have been able to leave. We have seen flights leaving from Thailand, flying people back to Indonesia, flying people back to China. But for the people that remain stuck in these compounds, their fate really is unknown, and it's still up in the air. And it's a big logistical challenge to sort this out as well. We are expecting a militia group essentially to function as a civil service, to engage with other countries that don't have diplomatic relations or don't have embassies in Thailand.
I'm curious, based on your reporting on this, do you think these crackdowns will continue and the amount of these scams will go down? Or do you think this is something that could pop up somewhere else or resurface in one way or another pretty soon?
For the militia groups, this really has been one of the best ways for them to make money in recent years. They need the money to fund their ongoing civil war. They need the money to fund the food and the resources that their citizens need in the areas that they control. And so I think it's highly unlikely that we're going to see these scam centers shut down altogether. We've heard also from people that are still working in the scam centers as we speak, some of them handcuffed to their desks to prevent them from leaving. So the scams really are continuing. For the 7,000 people that are now stuck in limbo, they may eventually be able to go home, but there are still upwards of 100,000 people stuck working in these scam centers in Myanmar.
That is journalist Jan Kamazan-Broomby reporting from Thailand. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Congress is expected to take up a Republican bill this week to fund the federal government through next September. The continuing resolution runs out at the end of this week, but it's not clear if House Speaker Mike Johnson has enough GOP votes to support it. If nothing is signed, a partial government shutdown is possible. Israel is ordering its power company to immediately cut off all electricity to Gaza. This after it blocked all aid, including food, fuel, and medical supplies into the enclave. It's the latest tactic Israel is using, trying to pressure Hamas to agree to an extension of the first phase of the ceasefire agreement. And thousands marched across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama today, commemorating the 60th anniversary of Bloody Sunday. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from The Station and from Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From USPS, USPS Ground Advantage service keeps customers in the know when their shipment leaves the dock, when it's on the move, and when it's delivered. Learn more at USPS.com/in-the-know. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. The night skies above the Chilean desert are the best in the world to see deep into space. But light pollution from a planned industrial project could change that, as John Bartlett reports.
When night falls over the Paranal Observatory, which operates one of the world's most powerful telescopes, the skies above are dusted with brilliant constellations and nebulae.
Te puedo mencionar miles, pero a lo mejor por seleccionar uno, por ejemplo, con el VLT.
The Very Large Telescope, or VLT, at Paranal began operations in 1998 and has taken readings which have won 3 Nobel Prizes. It is operated by the European Southern Observatory, led by Spanish astronomer Itziar de Gregorio.
La ESO es un organismo internacional de 16 países miembros, todos ellos europeos, del hemisferio norte.
De Gregorio explains that the unique confluence of factors, clear nights, low atmospheric pressure, and rare darkness, make this the best place in the world to observe the night sky. But this could soon change. Energy company AES Andes has put forward plans for the country's first industrial-scale green hydrogen and ammonia processing plant. It would be built just 7 miles from the observatory. But a new telescope is already under construction. All of this could be rendered ineffective if the nearby industrial project is greenlit. Towering over the Atacama Desert on Cerro Armazones, 3,000 meters above sea level, is the 80-meter steel dome of the extremely large telescope, the largest and most powerful ever built. I'm standing inside the structure, which is about 60% complete, on a narrow concrete walkway. In front of me, light will be bounced between 5 mirrors mounted on a central console, the largest of which will be 39 meters across. By the end of this decade, this telescope will allow us to peer well beyond our solar system to identify Earth-like exoplanets which might support life. The ELT will be 20 times more powerful than the VLT at Paranal. The telescope's main mirror will be made up of 798 individual hexagonal segments, painstakingly polished in a sealed laboratory upon arrival from Europe.
Mira, si los cielos se vuelven más mediocres,
if the light pollution increases significantly here, it would be equivalent to having a much smaller mirror. It means that the reasons why the ELT was built no longer make sense, De Gregorio tells me, as we shelter from the wind and sun in the bowels of the concrete structure. Chile's astronomical prowess will be lost. By day, the astronomers and technicians at Paranal have a band, Banda Sebas, which practices in a soundproofed room. There's a swimming pool, and cacti are arranged beneath a glass dome, ringed by an echoey cement walkway. When the last ray of sunlight touches a sensor on the residence's roof, a rose-like bunch of pleated fabric unfurls, sealing all light inside. And with that, the night shift begins.
Okay. Mi nombre es Marcela Espinosa, tengo 37 años. Y trabajo como operadora de telescopios e instrumentos en el Observatorio Paranal.
Marcela Espinosa is a Chilean astronomer working at the base.
Es lo cerca que van a estar. Entonces la contaminación lumínica.
The light pollution is going to be terrible for the observatory, Espinosa tells me. And that's what worries us, because we have this natural laboratory to study the universe. It could be catastrophic. A report by Chile's environmental regulator recommended moving the proposed site, and a decision is expected soon. Ultimately, if the astronomical community is unsuccessful in getting the project moved, our last great window into the universe could be lost forever. For NPR News, I'm John Bartlett at Paranal Observatory, Chile.
Renowned furniture designer and maker Thomas Moser died this past Wednesday. He was 90 years old. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports Moser's company created furniture for U.S. presidents and popes.
For more than 50 years, Thomas Moser Furniture has become known around the world for its craftsmanship and use of sustainable materials. A recent video on the company's YouTube channel describes the process in which the furniture is made at its headquarters in Auburn, Maine.
When the final handwork on a piece of furniture is complete, it's signed by the craftsperson who brought it to life.
Moser's wooden furnishings are understated and elegant with clean modern lines. At the same time, they are steeped in history. Moser talked about the influence of traditions like Shaker furniture on his work in a 2010 interview for the former NPR From Scratch podcast. The Shaker Christian sect's minimalist wooden tables, chests of drawers and chairs drew on principles of simplicity, honesty and utility.
What makes beauty, in my world, is that which serves. And if it doesn't have a functional component, a strong sense of utility, I am not interested in it.
Thomas Moser Furniture's marriage of beauty and utility made it popular in high places. The company furnished the George W. Bush Presidential Library and Archives, provided ceremonial seating for Pope Benedict, and designed a rocking chair for President Jimmy Carter. But its work also has broader appeal. Roseanne Summerson is a furniture designer and maker who co-founded the Rhode Island School of Design.
People saw purchasing a Thomas Moser piece as purchasing a kind of legacy object that would, you know, stay within their family or their realm for a long time to come.
Moser loved making things as a child, but he only got into the furniture business well into his 30s. His son Aaron Moser says his dad was a high school dropout who lost both of his parents to cancer when he was in his teens growing up near Chicago.
That left him a bit rebellious, I suppose.
Moser went into the military, traveled the world, earned a PhD in communications and got a teaching job at Bates College in Maine. He married his childhood sweetheart. Aaron Moser says his parents had four sons and needed to supplement their income, so they decided to get creative by fixing up antiques.
They would find an old chair or a dresser on the side of the road and they'd take it apart and put it back together again.
Moser eventually started making his own pieces. He founded Thomas Moser Furniture in 1972. The family sold the business to a holding company in January. The new management says it will preserve Thomas Moser's legacy. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
If you are a farmer of sheep, it is the busiest time of the year, lambing season. In the U.S., farmers usually arrange for new lambs to be born from late February to early April. That means long days of caring for pregnant ewes as they give birth, then monitoring the health of their little lambs. And hovering above it all, there are constant reminders of the cycle of life and death. Around this time last year, All Things Considered producer Avery Keatley caught up with one shepherd in Montgomery County, Maryland, as well as the newest members of her flock, and also her three sheepdogs.
Hi, puppies.
This is Nash, Arlo, Jenny. Welcome. I'm Amanda Cather, and I'm one of the owners and operators of Plow and Stars Farm in Poolsville, Maryland. This is our 10th year on this farm, so it feels like a long time. It's a decade, but in the life cycle of a farm, it's a blink of an eye. This is lambing time, and that's the time of year when our ewes, who have been gestating their lambs since September, are supposed to deliver the lambs. We check every 4 hours during lambing season. We check at 2 and 6 and 10 and 2 and 6 and 10 in this regular rhythm just to make sure everyone is fine, and just making sure that everyone is stable. So we see a ewe lying down by herself away from the rest of the flock, which is unusual. She might be in labor. Okay, I think this is Daenerys. She obviously wanted to be by herself for this. Hi, sweetie. Hi, mama. So she's looking around. She's making that little noise. She's gonna probably paw the ground in that nesting behavior. You can see she's got her flanks are all hollowed out. She's got her water bag hanging out. She seems pretty calm. And I think we'll just give her some time. I grew up in Southern Maryland and watched my dad work so hard outside at his small business, work every day, work every weekend, and swore that I would never do that. I would never work outside. We lived in an agricultural community, but I never really saw value in it as a kid. And then it came together for me really strongly in my junior and senior year of college, to the extent that I came home and told my parents I wasn't going to go to medical school after all. I instead wanted to become a farmer. The first year I tried to plant anything, I didn't know a plant from a weed and weeded up all of the carrots that we had planted and just had, you know, a learning curve. And then I went to do an apprenticeship on a farm and got to drive a tractor and met my first sheep, and then it was all over. So these lambs, they'll either be kept on the farm for breeding stock, or they will become butcher lambs. We'll raise them until they're 10 or 11 months old, and then we'll take them to a butcher shop in Pennsylvania that does our butchering for us. That day that we load the lambs is always hard. It's always a hard day, no matter how many times we do it. You know, we're not religious people, but a blessing is not too strong of a word for what we send them with. And gratitude, just our intense, intense gratitude for their lives. Often we get the question from people, how can you eat animals that you raise and you know? And at this point, I don't eat animals that I don't raise because I feel like I owe them the honor and respect of knowing that their life was a certain way. So we're able to give them a life here that is stress-free as much as we can. And then we give them as stress-free of an end as we possibly can. I know that as a livestock farmer, there are people who disagree with kind of the fundamental premise of eating animals and raising animals for meat. But if we are going to eat them, then I think we should raise them, and I think we should face what we're doing head on. And we do. I think as farmers, we're fortunate to be just very connected to those threads of life and death that are very, you know, the line between them can be very thin. The cycle of energy is the thing I think that really stands out to me lately, is the way that the energy from the sun goes into the pastures, is consumed by the animals, turned into protein, goes into our bodies, and our bodies will eventually return that cycle. And that feels right. It doesn't feel scary. Our lives, they're short. We don't know the circumstances of their ending. And the best we can do is try to be good stewards while we're here of whatever it is that we're given to steward. And we're all given to steward something. We're all given something to contribute. This is our small way of contributing. So we are heading out to the field to meet Daenerys' new baby boy. She might be getting ready to have another lamb. Or maybe she actually already did. She did have another lamb. She's got twins. Hooray. First lambs of 2024. Beautiful. Oh, hi. Right now she's cleaning the second lamb. The first lamb is lying. He's gonna get up pretty soon. He's a beautiful brown curly lamb with a white star on his head. And the second lamb is just getting up. The mother's cleaning off the amniotic fluid. She's doing a great job of licking her lamb clean and talking to her lamb. They're tired from being born. That's another ram lamb. This one is all brown. He's so pretty. This one's already getting ready to stand up, this second lamb. You're gonna get up and nurse in a minute? Whoa, he's up. How long has he been born? About 5 minutes, maybe? Nice job, buddy. So he's nursing him. This one's like, wait, I can't be left behind. He's like, let me get over there and get in there too. You got a lot to say? Oh, he's right here. Yeah, he's right here. That's great. That's a lot of lambs you had in there, Mama. And there he goes. All right. There.
That was Amanda Cather from Plow and Stars Farm in Poolsville, Maryland. Her story was produced by NPR's Avery Keatley. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Selma, Alabama is marking 60 years since historic voting rights marches there.
Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, turn me around, turn me around. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. I'm gonna keep on walking, keep on talking.
Thousands turned out today to symbolically cross the bridge where law enforcement officers attacked peaceful demonstrators in what became known as Bloody Sunday. The violence shocked the nation and helped create support for the 1965 Voting Rights Act. NPR's Debbie Elliott joins us now from Selma. Hey, Debbie.
Hey there.
What was the scene there today?
You know, it's what they call the bridge crossing jubilee, and the streets are packed, there are vendors, food stands. It's like a festival atmosphere. There's a gospel concert underway right now. Things kicked off with a rally at historic Brown Chapel AME Church. That was the site of mass meetings back in the 60s. It was led by Jeremy Ponce of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference.
Y'all ready to march?
Yeah.
Are y'all ready to march?
Yeah.
It's a shame that we still have to march 60 years later.
People left that church, marched to Selma's iconic Edmund Pettus Bridge. Remember, that's where state troopers and sheriff deputies attacked civil rights activists when they tried to march from Selma to Montgomery back in 1965.
Right. And since then, this anniversary has been marked in different ways, different years. How was it reenacted today?
Well, I think one thing that you notice right off is, you know, instead of being beat up by law officers, the crowd has police protection when they cross the bridge. And it's special because the foot soldiers who led that march 60 years ago are getting a lot of hero love, and they're on the front lines of this reenactment. Mm-hmm. The man who led Selma's voter registration project, Bernard Lafayette, for instance, was there crossing in a wheelchair. Eugene Daniels was there. He was just 17 years old when he was involved in the Selma movement. He said he'd been arrested a few times, but nothing to compare to what happened on March 7th.
On that Bloody Sunday, it never could expect what was going to happen, that was going to get ran down by Alabama State Police and then get beat by Billy Club with the sheriff riding on horses and tear gas. And it didn't matter what age of, you know, you were, old, young, everybody. When they call it Bloody Sunday, you can put an emphasis on that when they say Bloody Sunday, yeah?
Yeah, and another man who was standing with him showed me the scar on his head where he was bludgeoned on Edmund Pettus Bridge. Sanders says he thinks it's time to regroup to protect the gains that these people fought for back then. He says the fight's not over.
Why do people keep returning to the Edmund Pettus Bridge all these years later?
You know, many of the people I spoke with call it a touch point, this idea of connecting with a key piece of American history and uniting with others. One person likened it to holy ground. I've been to a lot of these over the years. I do pick up a sense of urgency this time with the changes the Trump administration is making to the government, things like eliminating diversity programs. Here's Sheila Bonds, who made the pilgrimage to Selma with the Indianapolis Coalition of 100 Black Women.
This change is not gonna take us away from our goals to progress, to make sure our people are being lifted up, and that we also have a piece of the American dream.
You know, Bonds and others say they fear a rollback of gains that were achieved by voting rights activists here back in 1965.
That is NPR correspondent Debbie Elliott. Debbie, always good to talk to you.
Thanks, Scott.
This is NPR News.
All 50 states report a reduction in deaths from illicit drugs.
We are on track to return to levels of overdose before fentanyl emerged.
That decline in deaths leaves the question of how to treat and care for the many drug users who are living. Monday on Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Secretary of State Marco Rubio heads to Saudi Arabia tomorrow, where he's to meet with his counterparts from Ukraine to talk about ways to end Russia's war in Ukraine. President Zelensky is scheduled to be in the country. On social media, he says Ukraine is fully committed to a constructive dialogue. A Black Lives Matter street mural in Washington, D.C. is set to be removed tomorrow amid pressure from the White House and Republican lawmakers. Legislation in Congress threatened to withhold federal money from the city if it isn't removed. It commemorates the murder of George Floyd by a Minneapolis police officer. And at the weekend box office, Mickey 17 debuted in the top spot with an estimated $19 million in ticket sales. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at WallaceFoundation.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. It is time for another conversation with our friends over at the Wildcard Podcast. This time, host Rachel Martin talks with acclaimed writer Zadie Smith about her biggest regret and why strangers make her cry. Here's Rachel.
One, two, or three.
Two.
What emotion do you understand better than all the others?
Gosh. Regret. I think that's the one I know very well. Yeah. I think people's lives are so profoundly shot through with regret. And they don't talk about it very often, particularly in America. It's like a failure, right, to...
Oh, it's like a four-letter word. And when people bring up the ideal of regret, you don't admit it because it's made you who you are, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I'm always hearing people on television saying, no regrets. Sorry, not sorry. I'm wow,
I don't
dude.
Believe that for one second.
I am so sorry. I am so filled with regret. It must be amazing never to feel sorry.
Right.
So, yeah, regret is something that I really feel, if only for the simple and selfish fact that you get one life, you know, and I'm so hungry for life that I could live it like 10 times. And once it's, you know, it's a tough deal.
May I ask if you're willing to share a thing that you wish you had done differently or that had gone differently?
I just wish I was less selfish. Writing is a very selfish thing to have done with your time. And it takes up all the time. And I wish I had done a bit less of it or thought about what else I could have done in that time. Because it's all I did. I just wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote, and wrote, which is great. But there's a lot of other things in life that you can do apart from that.
Yeah. It's the bummer about time.
Yeah. But it's cool. Like once I realized it, like I've taken steps, you know, I do other things now. I'm out in my community, I'm volunteering, I'm like engaged. And it feels so much better than sitting at a desk, just writing every day.
Well, it's also lonely, I imagine. Like just what that
work is. It is a little bit lonely. Like during COVID freaking out, I took it kind of personally because it's like, wait, so the thing you hate is my life?
Is my life.
You hate my life, but I've been living my life for 30 years. And to you, it's the worst thing imaginable. I'm like, oh.
To be sequestered at home.
Because I literally do that
thoughts.
Every day. So I did take it a little bit personally, but it was a wake-up call. I was like, this is not normal. People don't enjoy this. This thing that you do every day. You should try doing something else.
Three more cards. One, two, or three?
Three.
Okay. What period of your life do you often daydream about?
I really had a wonderful time in New York in my early 30s. You know, it was a wonderful period in my life, and I daydream about that a lot, particularly spring in New York. It's such a joy.
You were teaching at NYU, right?
That's not the part.
That's not the part that you did, to be fair.
It was more the evening activities. But yeah, I had a lot of fun. Like, I just met so many interesting people. It was extraordinary to me to be here. Despite all the kind of dramas of my adolescence, I do think about that period a lot because it's my feeling about teenagers that they are the purest of people. I know they're ridiculous a lot of the time, and I was for sure ridiculous, but they're philosophers. Like, they're experiencing things for the first time. They take them to heart. Both their politics and their existential lives are taken so personally. So to me, that's when my life seemed most real or something. It stays with you with clarity, both the sadnesses of it and the pains of it, but they were so acute. So I think I return to that period a lot. I guess I write about it a lot too.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. I mean, you're trying to figure yourself out, and everything is just heightened, and you have a lot of new ideas.
Heightened. It's so extreme. And I was never bored then. Mm. The world seemed, you know, so much to me and so present. Yeah.
Are you bored now?
You know, it's different. I still think I'm not easily bored because I can get a lot out of just, you know, just looking at anything. I get a lot out of just observing the world. So, and I'm understimulated, right? If you remember how life felt in like 1987, that's where I am at. It's a slower place. And so you're more in things, you know, Blossom, you can get me crying at Blossom or just a kid's face in the street or hearing two people argue in the subway or, you know, that's my stimulation and that's everywhere and continual.
Zadie Smith, the author of many books, including White Teeth, which is marking its 25th anniversary. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
If you're a certain age and you hear this music, I bet you can instantly conjure up an image of John Travolta strutting down the street with a can of paint. Staying Alive was his song, but I'm sure if you saw the movie, you have probably hummed it to yourself as you have walked down a sidewalk at least once. Or maybe, fast forward a few decades, you've got a big task coming up. Maybe some public speaking, a pitch meeting, one shot, as it were, one opportunity. You could say your palms are sweaty, knees weak, arms are heavy. So, like Eminem's character in 8 Mile, you pump yourself up with some Lose Yourself. I could go on, but the point is, music is a powerful part of movies. And some songs and some movies forge an instant link and stick together in your head for decades to come. That is what we're going to get into today with two guests from NPR Music, Stephen Thompson and Sydney Madden. Hey there.
Hello.
Hey, Scott.
How do we feel about those first two references?
I mean, Eminem did open a whole restaurant called Mom's Spaghetti in Detroit off the strength of that song, so clearly it had cultural staying power, and it became a staple from the movie.
I have heard that song approximately, I'm just guessing here, 4 to 6 billion times.
And I'm not a billion.
And I am still not tired of it. I will still turn it up every time it comes on the radio. So that is the mark of a great movie song.
I am excited to have this conversation, and I just want to start. I want to rattle off three examples of, to me, like, top-level songs and movies in sync, and then I would love for you to, like, I just want to get your views, and you guys do the same. So let me start with this. A few different things. I want to take you on a highway down a danger zone, zooming jets, spiked volleyballs, leather jackets. I feel like you have to start with Kenny Loggins, Highway to a Danger Zone, and Top Gun. To me, that's, like, up there. Got Fight the Power by Public Enemy and Do the Right Thing. Fight the Power! Fight the Power! It is the movie's anthem played over and over again.
Yo, is that the only tape you got? You don't like Public Enemy, man? This dope. I'm down, but you don't be playing nothing else.
I don't like nothing else.
And then I have to also reference Every Night in My Dreams, I See You, I Feel You. That is how I know you go on.
That is how I know you go on.
Can we top those three? Titanic, Do the Right Thing, Top Gun?
I mean, it is hard to top those three, Scott. Those are all excellent choices. I mean, we could just sit here and this entire segment could us just be naming movie songs we love, right? Like we could talk about Mrs. Robinson from The Graduate and how the way that song captures a certain rush that that movie brings about.
And here's to you.
We could just rattle off 80s movies. You already mentioned Danger Zone. We could talk a little Footloose to keep it with Loggins. We could talk about Ghostbusters.
If there's something strange in your neighborhood, who you gonna call?
I do love a certain kind of 80s movie theme song that really could only accompany the movie in question, where the song is actually calling out the name of the movie and reciting from the movie. I think that is a very kind of sweet era of you know, movies and songs converging.
And I love how, Stephen, you pinpointed in the 80s and 90s specifically, there were so many songs that narrated the movie for you or even had the title of the movie in it. I think of Exhale by Whitney Houston.
There comes a point when we exhale,
from Waiting to Exhale, which almost didn't even happen. She was so against recording songs for the movie. She really, really wanted to get into her actress bag for that, but then finally she was convinced to record that, and lucky for us, she was. For me, You Got a Friend in Me by Randy Newman will forever be the top of the top.
You got a friend in me. You got a friend in me.
Back in 95, it's so wild that Newman, who already had such an illustrious career, had never scored an animated movie before, let alone a Pixar movie. And of course, he's gone on to compose all the other soundtracks of the Toy Story movies.
He went
since
on to
then.
Basically rewrite that song over and over and over. Like every Pixar movie for a while would be like, you're my best friend.
If the formula is not broken, okay?
What's the problem?
Listen, like,
what's
the problem? The loafing tuba that comes in to accompany him, universal message that can be picked up by anybody, a kid of any age. But I also love songs that are so good that they actually transcend the movie. One song specifically is Aaliyah's Are You That Somebody from the Dr. Dolittle soundtrack, 1998.
It does transcend that film.
No shade to the directors, Eddie Murphy, Kyla Pratt, anyone involved, but there was no business having a song this sexy in a movie about talking animals. This song definitely did them a favor. It also moved incredibly well on the Billboard charts. It peaked at number 21 that the year it was released, and it earned Aaliyah her first Grammy nomination in the category of Best Female R&B and Vocal Performance. And again, from a movie about talking animals, y'all.
I feel like in talking about different examples, we talked about an interesting distinction here.
there are songs made for the movie, which, like you said, kind of peaked with the Ghostbusters era, like, you know. But then there's also so many different examples of movies taking a song that's been around for a long time and grafting it onto that movie. And you can't hear that song the same, like Unchained Melody with Ghost.
Oh, for sure. What are you doing?
I couldn't sleep.
Hard to hear that song and not think about Patrick Swayze doing the very sexual
pottery reel,
yeah. But like those are two different clear lanes here.
Yeah, we're talking about original songs in films versus needle drops. The phrase needle drop is just referring to when you're essentially hitting play on a pre-existing song in a movie, but allowing it to kind of be woven into the fabric of what you're seeing. And every once in a while, you see a movie with like a perfectly chosen needle drop, and you think there should be an Oscars category or music supervision. But a great needle drop can completely reshape a relationship with the song.
Let me ask both of you. I came in hot with like three or four top examples. Like which to each of you is like the platonic ideal of a movie and a song working together, bringing out the best in both of them, that you feel like this is the best example of these two things together?
Well, it's so funny because you reference the 80s and the 90s and the classics. And I do think sometimes it takes a bit of time and distance away to identify that this song is going to be linked to the film forever. But there are definitely exceptions with that. One exception is Redbone by Childish Gambino, which plays at the beginning of Jordan Peele's Get Out. Talk about musical synergy. So that song came out before the film did, but it beautifully narrates and foreshadows about the film's plot right there. It's smooth, it's ominous, it's bluesy, and it's telling you to stay vigilant, stay woke, because someone might be creeping up on you. Somebody might want to, I don't know, spoiler alert, take your body from you. And the entire premise of the movie is just laid out for you in the beginning montage, and this really
but in not too much of an over-the-top way, right? You're not like, oh, exactly. This is exactly what this movie is about if you're coming in cold. Steven, do you want to wind us down with one more favorite?
I'm really torn. If I'm talking about the platonic ideal, I would need to pick either something from Purple Rain, whether it's When Doves Cry or Purple Rain itself, or I would talk about the theme from Shaft. By Isaac Hayes, which is, again, we're talking about not only like reciting character beats, laying out exactly who the character is and what he's all about in a way
in a deeply straightforward
way, but also with one of the greatest instrumental like backing tracks behind it you can possibly imagine. Those horns are so iconic and so amazing, and that song is funny and weird and could only be from the film Shaft. So I
want to see this movie about Shaft. What do I need to know about
this
gentleman?
Tell me a little bit more about this Shaft.
Who is the man that would risk his neck for his brother, man? Can you dig it?
That to me, I mean, if we're going to name platonic ideals, let's go with that one.
You have me sold. That is NPR Music, Stephen Thompson and Sydney Madden. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a complicated show, this All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow. Thanks for listening. We will talk to you again soon.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Subaru Outback with standard symmetrical all-wheel drive and up to 9.5 inches of ground clearance. Learn more at Subaru.com/Outback. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from ECMC Foundation, at ecmcfoundation.org.